This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On July 26, 1990, President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law with a goal of creating equal opportunities for people with disabilities through inclusion in the workplace, in schools, and in the community. As the nation recognizes the 25th anniversary of the ADA, we'll look at the legal, societal, and personal aspects of the law. We start by taking a look at the history of the ADA and how the law is interpreted and enacted today. And joining us are Kelly Holden, an attorney with Dressman, Benzinger, Lavelle, Assistant United States Attorney Margaret Castro, and attorney Andrew Kaplan, a partner with Voorhees, Sater, Seymour, and Pease. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Andy, Kelly, and Margaret, thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Andy, give us a little background on the ADA, the origins of the law, how it came to be.
Sure, Mark. If you go back before 1990, you would see that there was no comprehensive civil rights legislation to protect the disabled in the United States. And the result of that was we didn't have any of the kinds of public accommodations that we see today. Disabled persons had great difficulty getting into the workforce. We had sheltered workshops where they were paid sub-minimum wage, but didn't really have integrated workplaces where the disabled could use their talents and better our places of employment, frankly. So then President Bush, the first President Bush, promised when he was running for office that he would sign a bill protecting the rights of the disabled. And there had been a survey actually in 1986 which had found that disabled persons were unable to basically break into the workforce. Two-thirds of disabled persons reported as being unemployed, and that was despite the fact that most of them wanted to work. So all of that was going on at that time, and it led to some action in Congress. It began really with Representative Tony Coelho in the House. He had personal experience with disability. He was an epileptic. He sponsored the bill in the House. Senator Lowell Weicker sponsored the bill in the Senate, but then he lost his reelection bid, and Tom Harkin, who most of your listeners would be familiar with, recently retired from the Senate, stepped in and pushed the bill in the Senate. He had a personal connection as well. He has a brother who is deaf and a nephew who had become paraplegic. So the bill works its way through Congress and passed by wide margins, something in the order of 12 to 15 to 1 yes to no votes. President Bush signed it into law, and it went into effect in 1990.
Margaret?
Well, what's interesting, Mark, is that the bill did take some time to pass. It was first introduced in 1988, and as it worked its way through the committee, it kept stalling. And so what disability rights advocates decided to do was a march on Washington, where they came in from 30 states throughout the country, all gathered in Washington, had a gathering, and then 60 of those civil rights advocates who were in wheelchairs decided to climb the steps of the Capitol building. There are about 83 steps up to the top of the Capitol.
That was the Capitol crawl.
Yes, that's what it was called, the Capitol crawl. The most notable one of those was an 8-year-old girl from Denver who had cerebral palsy, and she got out of her wheelchair and climbed up those 83 steps. And many people in the disability rights community believe that it is that demonstration that led Congress to pass it, as Andy said, so overwhelmingly.
I guess there were some senators and congressmen who might have been sitting on the fence, and that swayed them.
I would say so.
Yeah, quite a demonstration, quite an effective one. Kelly, I've often heard this described as wide-ranging and comprehensive. What makes the ADA wide-ranging and comprehensive? Why are those words used to describe it?
Sure. It is very wide-ranging and comprehensive. It has three different titles, five different titles, but three that most people are familiar with. And the first part is the employment piece of it, which is what I deal with in my practice the most, and trying to make sure that disabled individuals have access to the workplace and that they're not discriminated in the workplace. And then Title II deals with state and local governments. And Title III is really what a lot of people are familiar with, the handicap parking spaces, the accessibility to get into buildings, and making sure that disabled people who are in wheelchairs or have physical disabilities are able to access that. But then it expands beyond that to make sure someone maybe with some type of learning disability is able to have proper access to education and things of that nature. So it covers a lot of different areas that people have to comply with.
And so there were five titles altogether, and that,
right.
You've gone through three.
Right.
Was there one that deals with telecommunications? Was that three?
Margaret,
that's Title
right.
Four.
That's four.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Title Four. That's rather interesting because that's resulted in TTY and different types of devices that people who are deaf and people who have vision problems can use to communicate, right?
Absolutely, and it's been highly successful. One of the interesting issues that's coming up now is how does that apply to websites?
Mm-hmm.
As websites have become widely used by the public, questions that the courts have taken up is how do we make websites so accessible as we have done successfully with TV and radio?
Yeah, there was actually a case, National Federation of the Blind, I think, sued Target Corporation over their website because it wasn't conducive to people who were low or no vision.
That's absolutely right, and they won that case successfully. There are cases throughout the country in which courts have been dealing with this issue, and there is some conflict of whether or not the ADA applies to websites that the courts are grappling with at this time.
Andy, I've often seen articles say that this was modeled after the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Is that correct?
That's correct, but it's also different from the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and other civil rights laws. And the big difference is that while all of these laws prohibit discrimination against persons within whatever the protected class might be, Civil Rights Act of 1964, we're talking about race discrimination, sex discrimination, religious discrimination, those sorts of things. ADA, obviously, is disability. But in addition to the anti-discrimination provisions of the ADA, there is something called reasonable accommodation. And that is really sort of an affirmative action aspect of the law that places the responsibility on an employer of a disabled employee or an employer who's looking to hire people to provide a reasonable accommodation to a qualified individual with a disability, which means to provide some assistance so that that person can perform the essential functions of the job.
Now, does this apply to all employers or just certain size employers?
The ADA applies to employers with 15 or more employees, but it's also important to keep in mind that Ohio has its own Civil Rights Act, and that also prohibits discrimination against the disabled, among other groups. And the Ohio Civil Rights Act applies to employers with four or more employees.
And Kentucky has its own Civil Rights Act as well, and it applies if you have eight or more.
Did these come after the ADA, or were these prior to the ADA? You know?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that Kentucky and Ohio were modeled after Title VII, and then I think after the ADA, they added the disability provision.
Margaret, tell us, what specifically does the ADA do? Andy mentioned reasonable accommodations. That's one of the issues it covers. It covers, what, two or three different areas?
It does. As we were discussing, it can be Title I cases, which arise out mm-hmm. of situations in employment. What my office, as a part of the Department of Justice, does is issues rising out of Title II and Title III and public accommodations and places in the state and local government. So what that could mean is issues with accessibility into public buildings, libraries, for instance, schools. It could also be parks. And if you think about it, it's not just what we might consider to be obvious disabilities, but also accessibility issues for people with learning impairments, developmental delays, and issues such as those.
Well, the main thing is it's prohibiting discrimination because somebody has a disability. That's the gist of the law, right?
Absolutely.
Now, how does the ADA define an individual with a disability?
Well, it's actually very clear, and the definition of disability is very broad. In 2008, Congress passed an amendment to the ADA, broadening the definition of disability to be a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. And when we talk about major life activities, that can be seeing, hearing, but it also can be the ability to sit and concentrate. So it really is a broad definition that Congress intended to sweep widely and be very inclusive.
And Mark, That's exactly right. Margaret's right on the money there, because the reason that the ADA Amendments Act was passed in 2008 and it went into effect in 2009 was precisely because Congress felt that its original intent in the ADA wasn't being realized. They thought that the courts were interpreting the law too narrowly and not enough people were falling under the definition of a disability. So they did several things to broaden the coverage under the Act. One of them was with respect to what's called mitigating measures. The question had been before the Amendments Act in 2008, do we look at the person in terms of their ability to perform major life activities with or without their medications, with or without some sort of assistive device? And the Supreme Court at that time had said that we look at them with those assistive devices or medications. So if you take a diabetic, for example, who is on an insulin regimen and is functioning seemingly perfectly fine with respect to the activities of daily living, that person under the Supreme Court decision would not have been treated as a disabled person protected by the Act. However, under the Amendments Act, Congress made it clear that we hypothetically take away medications and assistive devices and see whether that person would be substantially limited in one or more major life activities if we did that. For a diabetic, that could mean going into having a diabetic stroke. It could mean having concentration issues, and those, of course, would interfere with major life activities and therefore be disabilities.
I guess in all cases, though, you're looking at a long-term disability. You're not looking at somebody who maybe has a broken leg or a sprain or might have the flu or pneumonia or something like that. These are long-term conditions.
You're exactly right about that. No one knows exactly how long-term the conditions have to be. The law isn't clear about that. There's no bright line rule. But you're right. If you have a bone that breaks that heals normally, that's not going to be considered a disability. The flu's not a disability. The common cold's not a disability.
Kelly, what's your perspective on how disability is defined by this law?
Very broadly. I completely agree with Margaret, and particularly after the amendments in 2008. I do a lot of training for my clients, and I sort of jokingly say you should just consider people are disabled and not discriminate against them because the law is very broad. And when people ask for an accommodation, what I do when I train people is tell them you have to consider every single accommodation. You may not have to grant everyone because it does have to be reasonable, and that is a very fact-by-fact analysis that you have to do. But you do have to consider everyone and try the best you can to accommodate individuals in the workplace.
How do they define reasonable?
Well, that's a great question, and there's probably thousands of court cases on that very question.
There's no one concise answer yet.
There's not one concise answer, which makes it difficult to comply with from an employment perspective because it's not a black and white test, and there's not a right answer to every case. You have to really consider what is the person's disability, what are they requesting, what's the workplace, what is their job, and look at all of those factors in order to determine what is reasonable.
We will continue our conversation about the Americans with Disabilities Act, and you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. My guest this afternoon, Kelly Holden, an attorney with Dressman Benzinger Lavelle, Assistant United States Attorney Margaret Castro, and Attorney Andrew Kaplan, a partner with Voorhees, Sater, Seymour, and Pease. 513-419-7100 to join the conversation about the Americans with Disabilities Act. You can also email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Margaret, can you give an example of what would be considered a reasonable accommodation and then something that might be considered an unreasonable accommodation?
Of course. Something that may be considered reasonable would be something as simple as cutting out a ramp into a set of stairs into a building if a disabled person in a wheelchair is unable to get up the stairs to that building. Now, what the courts typically look at is the size of the company that is being required to implement these things. Large corporations, for example, have more resources than small businesses. So for large companies, something like cutting out part of a sidewalk or an entryway would be very simple for them. Something that the courts are grappling with now is what could be unreasonable is how to make websites be able to have words audially for or words for people who cannot look at the screen, but have them be able to appear for them through sound. And so that's something that is becoming more mainstream right now.
513-419-7100 to join our conversation. Kelly, does the Act actually have a specific list of conditions, or does it just kind of leave it open?
There are some examples within the actual regulations that talk about, you know, people who are disabled from walking, hearing, seeing. And really, when the Act was first passed, I think that was the intent of it. You know, people who were in wheelchairs, people that were sight impaired, hearing impaired. But as the Act came into place, particularly in the workplace, which is what I'm most familiar with, the Act expanded to people who maybe have a chronic back condition, and then do they need accommodations? And as Margaret said, when they passed the amendments, they really expanded that and addressed that. Instead of that person has a chronic condition, not an acute condition, but a chronic condition that substantially limits one of those major life activities that is considered a disability now.
And Mark, to follow up on what Kelly's saying, we also know from the Amendments Act in 2008, went into effect in 2009, that a substantial limitation in the functioning of a bodily system, something internal to that person, is also considered a disability. So we tend to think about activities of daily living as being speaking, hearing, reading, sitting, standing, walking, some of the things that we see outward manifestations of. But the ADA Amendments Act told us that if there is a limitation of a bodily function, and the bodily function could be cardiovascular, neurological, any of a number of bodily systems, that alone, that internal development can itself give rise to the finding that the person is a disability. So an example would be a person, again, let's go to a diabetic who has a malfunctioning endocrine system, I believe. That internal process is a substantial limitation of a major life activity and will be considered a disability.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And let's talk with Tom in Fort Mitchell. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll be brief and then get off. I'm a pediatrician, so I help kids. A large part of my job is to help facilitate things for kids. But I heard a story on the NPR in the last year or two, and I worried that it was an abuse that would create fallout. And I don't know if it applies to this story or not, to your act, but this was South Asian American shopkeepers who had stores that couldn't accommodate people in wheelchairs. And apparently there was an attorney there famous for getting clients to take the shopkeepers to court and winning settlements, or else the shopkeepers had to make accommodations which they couldn't afford. So I don't know if this applies to what you're talking about, but I was just concerned with how do you deal with potential for abuses of the Act. And okay, I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks, Tom. Margaret, did you?
Well, certainly anyone that has a public accommodation is required to abide by the ADA. And I don't know the circumstances of this particular case. I had not heard about this. But anyone that opens up a public shop to the public is required to make that shop accessible to persons with disabilities.
I've actually handled a couple of those cases. There is grandfathering for businesses that existed prior to 1990, but if the business makes a substantial modification, and that's a pretty liberal definition, then they do have to comply with the accessibility requirements of the ADA. And sometimes smaller business owners who maybe don't hire a contractor that's familiar with that will have problems and learn that their building is not accessible, and then they can be sued for that.
Let's talk with, did you want to add something else, Margaret?
What I was going to say is, just as a public service announcement, too, an issue that we've seen come up pretty regularly with the government is allowing access of service animals into public places. Mm-hmm. And it is possible that someone will come into a restaurant and there's confusion about whether health citations come into play. But if there is a qualified person with a disability that has a trained service animal, usually a dog, with them, that person is permitted to bring that service animal into a restaurant.
Okay, thank you, Margaret. And let's talk with Ruth and Anderson. Hi, Ruth, how are you?
Hi. My question kind of piggybacks on the prior call. I'm wondering why there are stores or public places of business that provide handicap parking spots but do not necessarily provide accessible doors to get into the establishment. And I'll give as an example the Anderson Town Center. Now, that's a fairly new shopping center. And I actually called the development company prior to the building of that town center to ask them about making the doors accessible, and they said that was up to the individual business, and that was not done. There are parking spaces for handicapped people, but you cannot get into the doors.
Okay. Thank you, Ruth.
Anyway. That is something that's worth looking into. I do not have specifics about the Anderson Town Center, but there are requirements. I know that's a fairly new development out there in Anderson, and if it has been built recently, it would be required to have accessible entryways.
So they've done the parking lot. They've made the parking lot accessible, mm-hmm. but they haven't made the stores themselves, and what they're mm-hmm. saying is that it's the individual, it's the lease, it's the person who's leasing that property who's responsible. Does that sound right? No.
I would say the building owner would be responsible, and whether or not the door has to be accessible, you know, and I'm thinking of someone in a wheelchair, for instance, who maybe can't reach a door handle to open the door. It's probably something addressed in the regulations.
Okay, let's talk with Ray in Finneytown. Hi, Ray.
Hi, yeah, how's it going? I had a question about people with mental or personality disorders. I suffer from anxiety and panic attacks, and I've had difficulty finding a job where I wouldn't be worried that if I got overwhelmed, I could kind of step back. So if you guys could talk about that, maybe.
Okay. Thanks, Ray.
Well, that's an interesting question, Ray. And one of the things that we have to be thinking about when we talk about the coverage of this act is it applies to people who are qualified and have a disability. And I'm not sure we've covered the qualified piece today. And this is not to suggest that you are or are not qualified for the position, but we have to understand what it means. Qualified means having the resume qualifications for the job, but then it means something else. It also means that you can perform the essential functions of the job with or without a little assistance from your employer, with or without a reasonable accommodation. So it sounds like the question in your case may well be whether your condition is such that you simply can't do the essential functions of the job, or whether there's some accommodation that this prospective employer could offer you that would enable you, with your impairment, to get those essential functions done. The ADA does not require an employer to eliminate essential functions of the job. That's not considered a reasonable accommodation.
And then also, I would just add to that, it's the individual's obligation to identify what accommodations they think they need. It's not for the employer to figure out that the person has a disability and then identify the accommodations. So I always tell the employees they have to go to whoever their health care provider or whoever is treating them and determine what type of accommodations to give suggestions and work with the employer.
And as an example for our caller who said he suffers from panic attacks and anxiety, a simple accommodation for that may be that he needs a break every 5 minutes out of it for whatever hour he works. And it may be something as simple as that to give him a little quiet time to be by himself, and then he can return and continue on with his job for the next 7 hours of his shift.
Let's talk with Catherine in Fort Thomas. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I have a question, and then I'll just listen to it off the air. I have a son who has a food allergy. It's very serious. He's anaphylactic. And I learned that food allergies are also covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I was just wondering what you think are reasonable accommodations for schools and also workplaces to make for people with food allergies.
Okay. Thank you, Catherine.
It's very possible. I know schools right now have separate zones for children with allergies. They disinfect and clean those areas during the lunch hour for those children. They sit in separate areas. And so there are certainly accommodations that can be made for children that are suffering from those problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that, that the schools would have an obligation because that I have a nephew with a food allergy, the same thing. And it is very serious. And it's important for the child to know that and the parent to inform whoever they need to inform. And they should make those accommodations for that child.
So we're coming up on 25 years. From each of you, I'd like to hear what you think has been the overall impact of the law. Kelly, why don't you go ahead and start?
The law's had a wide ranging impact on so many different areas. I've dealt with it with the accessibility, and I've dealt with it with employment. And with the employment aspect, it's been great to allow workplaces to be open, you know, to employ people with disabilities. Like any law, it has been subject to a little bit of abuse. I often see cases where there is some abuse and someone doesn't truly have a disability and isn't capable of performing the job. But that's going to happen with any law and anything in the United States. But it's had a wide-ranging effect, I think, more so than probably most laws.
Margaret?
What I've been happy to see is the recognition of mental illnesses and developmental delay and conditions being recognized as disabilities where that may not have been the case 25 years ago. And we're now seeing, as we heard from our caller, and employers being more willing to accommodate those types of conditions that perhaps aren't as visible as some of the other conditions that we think of as disabling.
Andy.
And I think we've seen that definitely employers have become more sophisticated in their understanding of the law over time. The result of that is there is more accommodation in the workplace. They know when they have a situation that requires some assistance, and they'll pick up the phone and call for some guidance. But truly, I think that employers try very hard to comply with the law. Sometimes it's not so easy to know what the right or wrong answer is, but it just requires some talking to and some work directly with the employee through the interactive process so we can make these arrangements work.
Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us this afternoon. Kelly Holden is an attorney with Dressman Benzinger Lavelle, Assistant United States Attorney Margaret Castro, and Attorney Andrew Kaplan, a partner with Voorhees, Sater, Seymour & Pease. And coming up, we'll continue our discussion about the Americans with Disabilities Act with a look at its effects on the daily lives of individuals and families. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.